Resources Committee order. We have President Senator Halford, Senator Taylor, Vice Chairman Pierce, myself, the Chairman, Senator Lehman, and Senator Hoffman. We have a full schedule for today. We do have several people waiting on teleconference, and we have one who's in Washington, D.C., who's been waiting, and I know it's, what, about 7:30, 7:40, whatever it is there. So sorry for holding you up. The first item that we will take up is Senate Joint Resolution 38. This is a resolution opposing the proposed expansion of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Toxics Release Inventory Program. As I mentioned on the Senate floor last week, this is information that I and Senator Pierce picked up at the Energy Council meeting last week when we were in Washington. Mark Rubin from the American Petroleum Institute briefed us on this. The EPA is proposing to expand the TRI program to include oil and gas exploration and production, as well as some other categories. The downside to this, as I think Mr. Rubin will testify in more detail, is that will likely make oil and gas producers the biggest polluters of the state, because they are pulling from a formation and treat the oil and the gas and separate it and take the produced water and produce gas and re-inject it. And it doesn't make any sense to have to monitor that and test it and report it as a toxics release. Just so, having said that, Mr. Rubin in Washington, would you like to provide testimony? You'll be testifying to the Senate Resources Committee.
How long would you like for me to speak on this?
1 minute. We'd like you to do the abbreviated version.
Okay. The toxics release inventory program, many of you may be familiar with it. Currently requires that a number of manufacturing industries report for 651 toxic chemicals. They report for their releases to the environment. The Environmental Protection Agency is currently considering whether to include additional industries in this program. One of those industries, of course, is the oil and gas exploration and production industry. The E&P industry would have to report for about 80 or so chemicals that we have, some of which occur naturally in oil, gas, and produced water. Examples would include benzene or toluene or ethylbenzene or xylene. And then other chemicals that we add to our process, like hydrochloric acid when we acidize a well, or ethanol, or something like that. The agency is, if they expand this program to the E&P industry, API estimates about 4,700 or more E&P facilities would likely have to report under this program. The first year cost to the industry would be about $228 million, and annual cost thereafter would be about $110 million per year. The average cost for an onshore oil or gas bill would be about $58,000 in the first year, about $10,000 each year thereafter. We believe strongly that the TRI program is really not designed for the E&P industry. It's designed more for businesses that are in close proximity to communities. As you all know, the most E&P facilities are away from communities, or out in remote rural areas, or they are offshore. The those facilities that we have very few actual releases to the environment, except for our underground injection wells. And of course, EPA considers underground injection to be a release to the environment. And as I'm sure you know, most of our underground injection is back into either to the oil and gas reservoir or into a similarly deep reservoir where we inject those fluids. The EPA believes strongly that the TRI program has been a great success. And one of the big reasons that the TRI program has been considered a success is because it's led to voluntary reductions and releases from some of the facilities that report. In fact, for our industry, the largest volume of releases is likely to be naturally occurring constituents of oil, gas, water. So reducing those releases is going to be extremely, well, it's going to be impossible without shutting in wells. As Senator Lehman mentioned, I believe, or at least the resolution mentioned, a couple of government facilities, Elk Hills and other DOE facilities, have reported ECRI program, and Elk Hills in particular pointed out a real problem with this program. Elk Hills, in the first year they reported, they had 3.7 million pounds of releases. About 99.5% of those releases were injected into the oil and gas reservoir, yet that facility was called the largest polluter in Kern County, even though all the releases on those, or 99.5%, were into the oil and gas reservoir. We are, the industry is not opposed to providing more information to the public, but we're not opposed to providing information that has value to the public. And we have recommended to the Environmental Protection Agency that instead of expanding the TRI program, that we take a step back and look at what type of information is really needed by the public, that we work with the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, with the state regulators through that commission, and include environment or EPA officials on a committee and environmental organizations on a committee that would take a look and see what the real needs are by the community, and that we find a cost-effective way to provide that information to the community, as opposed to the very costly and what we believe is an inappropriate TRI program. And those are my remarks, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions, Mr. Rubin? Thank you, Mr. Rubin, for being with us, and especially for staying over late in the evening in Washington, D.C. In Anchorage, Faye Sullivan.
My name is Faye Sullivan, and I'm a senior environmental scientist for UNICAL Oil and Gas. UNICAL supports the proposed joint resolution opposing expansion of the TRI program. The original TRI was established to provide information to the public about potential chemical releases and the risk of these releases to the local community. It's not appropriate to expand TRI reporting to the oil and gas industry, which generally operates in remote areas or offshore. Oil and gas facilities have limited release potential and present a very low risk to the public. Typical oil and gas reportable releases would include discharges of produced water, underground injection of waste, and air emissions from combustion sources. All of these activities are currently strictly regulated by existing federal and state programs. Use of chemicals can vary in the oil and gas industry from day to day and week to week, depending upon the work at the facility. Expanding the TRI program would force operators to conduct regular, expensive waste stream tests and create a costly accounting burden with no environmental benefit. Many older fields are economically marginal now. Their expected lifetimes decrease with each additional regulatory burden placed on them. Therefore, UNICAL urges you to pass this resolution and discourage expansion of the TRI program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Is there anybody else signed up to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 38? Mark Wheeler? And that's all that I have.
For the record, my name is Mark Wheeler, and I represent the Alaska Environmental Lobby. I have a short position paper to read to you today. The Alaska Environmental Lobby supports the free and easy access to information on toxic chemical releases. It is the right of the public to know what toxic chemicals are released into the air and water. We commend EPA's efforts to increase the scope of their reports to include other industries with high potential for toxic pollution, including mining facilities, waste management facilities, and electric utilities. We urge the legislature to reject this resolution and to seek to help the public gain more knowledge, not less, about toxic releases into our air and water. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. I don't want to suggest by having this resolution that we would endorse anything that says that the community shouldn't have a right to know. In fact, you know, we've spoken out strongly in favor of community right to know ordinances and those provisions. Thank you.
I'd like to note that the testimony was all about the petroleum industry, and there's other industries that are regulated with a new increase in the TRI reports.
Is there any committee discussion regarding the resolution? Senator Pierce?
I would move the resolution with individual recommendations, and does it have fiscal, and it's zero fiscal mark.
Is there any objection to the motion to report the resolution? Hearing none, Senate Joint Resolution is reported from the Resources Committee. Next is Senate Joint Resolution 39 relating to NPDES permits for placer mining. And we have in Anchorage Steve Burrell with the Alaska Miners Association for a brief statement regarding this resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Burrell, and I'm testifying on behalf of the association. We wish to go on record supporting SJR 39. I have sent to your office there two potential changes that we might suggest. The resolution is written references dredge and recreational mining. However, the issue goes far beyond just dredge and recreational mining, and it affects any commercial mining operation. And the first of the two suggested changes would touch on just two points, how it affects commercial operators. And the second change that we would recommend deals with just giving full due deference to the folks that have caused the problem as we see it. We suggest that the addition of the litigants be included in addition to their attorneys. And that's the end of my comments. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your comments. Do we have anybody else signed up to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 39? We have two proposed amendments by Alaska Miners. I consider them to be friendly amendments, and I think they actually help improve the resolution. It's the pleasure of the committee regarding the amendments.
You need to move on.
Okay, Senator Taylor?
You just need to move on.
Okay, well, I'll move the...
You can't.
Okay,
I'll move amendment number one.
Okay. Number one is the adds a new whereas clause in this letter. Everybody understand the amendment? Is there any objection to amendment number one? Hearing none, amendment number one is adopted.
I would move amendment number two.
Did everybody understand amendment number two? Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, amendment number two is adopted. It's the pleasure of the committee regarding Senate Joint Resolution 39 as amended.
Move the resolution from committee as amended.
Hold it before we do. We hold that motion. We have signed up to testify. David Chambers? You wish to testify?
Yes, sir.
Please. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Fine.
My name is David Chambers. I'm the mining analyst with the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. I'm a geophysicist and a planner by training. I'm not an attorney. And I was one of the people involved in the negotiation of this settlement agreement that's at issue with this resolution. I'd like to make a couple of just quick comments on the resolution. I'm concerned that some of the statements in Joint Resolution 39 are somewhat misleading, particularly in the first whereas on page 1, where it says requiring all dredges for the first time ever to have an NPDES permit, despite the fact that EPA does not have the personnel to process all of these newly required permits. While it's true that this settlement agreement does require that small suction dredgers for the first time have to have an NPDES permit, which is, by the way, required by the law, all that's required under the settlement agreement is that the suction dredgers in question send their name and address to EPA and in turn receive from EPA a one-page sheet that lists best management practices to follow. So I don't think this is an onerous requirement, and again, it meets the requirements of the law. The second bullet says requiring an arsenic level of 0.18 parts per billion. While again, that's factually correct, this is a requirement of state and federal law, and to the best of my knowledge, during the course of our year and a half negotiations, we never once discussed the arsenic level at its numerical limit. So this is just merely a number that EPA is putting in the permit. It's required to do so by law, and should EPA change its standard, as is referred to in the next line, to 50 parts per billion or whatever, I assume that that would become a part of this permit as it would all other permits. The settlement agreement involved some detailed negotiations between the EPA, the state, and ourselves representing our clients, and it required compromise on everyone's part. For instance, we went in to the negotiation asking for monitoring requirements for 10 metals and turbidity once per week, as is done with other NPDES permits. The old permit required arsenic and turbidity once per year. We compromised at arsenic and turbidity three times per year, quite a bit less than what we had gone in asking for. The old requirements for suction dredges required no registration, no monitoring, no reporting for the small miners. We went in asking to know who they were, where they were operating, and for them to make some sort of certification at the end of the season that they were complying with their best management practices. We came out with a compromise of just knowing who they were and being notified that there were these best management practices. I think these two examples are indicative of the sort of compromise that we tried to seek in these negotiations. By the way, towards the end of the negotiations, the miners were invited to comment. They chose not to do so. So EPA, I think it's fair to say that EPA entered into this settlement agreement because its position under our legal challenge was weak. And I would like to argue to this committee that the settlement agreement is in the best interest of the state, because if the terms of this settlement agreement are not complied with, and we do indeed end up in court to represent our clients, we're going to go back to our original negotiating position. That's the position we'll have to present to the court, and I'm not sure that that's in the best interest of everyone involved to be in that position again, to be looking at a court-imposed solution to this instead of a settlement agreement solution. Finally, I'd like to say that if there are perceived weaknesses in this settlement agreement, as far as I'm concerned, the door is still open to the miners or anyone else to come to us with proposals to change it. That door has not been closed. It never was. It's just that one of the parties that's potentially affected by this agreement chose not to participate in it. I believe that's all I have. If there's any questions I can answer, I'd be glad to make an attempt at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chambers. I might note that I applaud you for keeping your door open. This is like a letter from the legislature. In this case, it's started by this committee, and I would hope that the legislature will approve it, and it will, since the door is open, we'll slip it through your door and let you know that there are some things that we don't agree with in that settlement, and that's, the main thing that we're doing with this resolution. Let me ask a question on the arsenic level. You say that, at least what I heard in your testimony, that's not hard and fast, that it could be changed to 50 parts per billion from 0.18 parts per billion. There's a large difference between the two numbers, and I'm not sure why you settled at 0.18 parts per billion, which is considerably lower than the requirement for drinking water.
Again, that 0.18 is just a mirror, is just a reflection of what the state and federal standard is, and it really is not an element of our settlement agreement.
Okay. And further questions of Mr. Chambers? Senator Taylor?
Just one. The Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit against
EPA. We challenged the EPA permit, yes, sir?
And
on behalf of our clients.
The Sierra Club.
On behalf of our clients, American Rivers and the Northern Alaska Environmental Center, not the Sierra Club.
Well, it says in the resolution that it says lawsuit filed by Sierra Club Defense.
They're like the attorneys on behalf of, we just passed the amendment that said it was on behalf of the American Rivers and Northern Alaska Environmental Center.
The Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund is a nonprofit law firm, and it is not legally related to the Sierra Club.
I wasn't concerned so much about that. I was just wondering who the actual parties were to the litigation. You said the miners did not participate in the settlement. Were the miners a party to this litigation?
No, they weren't. I assume they chose not to intervene.
But that's who was being impacted by the suit, isn't it?
ultimately a miner gets the permit, yes.
Further questions? Thanks for your testimony. Mr. Wheeler, did you wish to testify in this resolution also?
Yes.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Mark Wheeler with the Alaskan Environmental Lobby. The recently released draft NPDES permit for placer mining in Alaska is the result of 1.5 years of settlement negotiations between the EPA, the State of Alaska, and the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. The draft permit is a good compromise agreement which seeks to protect water quality in the State of Alaska. In the compromise agreement, concessions were made on all sides. As a result of this agreement, the court system is prohibited from imposing stricter standards on placer mining in Alaska. We encourage the legislature to support this compromise agreement by rejecting the proposed resolution.
Questions? Senator Taylor?
Yeah, I probably should have asked the other gentleman, but is it in fact true that 0.18 parts per billion is a lower standard than what we've currently established for drinking water?
I'm not sure of that.
Maybe the other gentleman could respond to that.
The current standard for drinking water is 50 parts per billion, so that 0.18 is obviously quite a bit lower. That 0.18 is based on a human health risk, a carcinogenic risk for cancer. The 50 parts per billion is not based on that number, and that's why there's a difference between them.
If I could?
Please.
"50 parts per billion, which is what we allow our children to drink as water in municipal water systems, is not based on a health standard?"
It's not based on risk of arsenic as a carcinogen. That's what the 0.18 part per billion is based on.
So,
at a risk level of 1 in 100,000, which was set by the state.
So in other words, we're currently requiring, you said this was existing law, we're currently requiring people processing gravel to produce water, that the water or effluent that they produce has to be, what's that, 2.5 times cleaner of arsenic than what our drinking water systems are?
No, that same arsenic number would apply to drinking water systems too. That number applies to any water that is used for drinking water, for human consumption. That's what sets that value.
No, I realize the 50 parts would apply to drinking water. Mm-hmm. I meant that the current standard that you're talking about for placer miners or people out there processing gravel somehow to get ore out of it is 18 is to 50, about 2.5 times.
Robin, it's 200, about 260. It's 0.18 compared to 50.
Oh yes. Well, that is.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm sorry.
So, in other words, they have to be 260 times cleaner if you're going to process gravel than we have to be if we're going to produce water for our children to drink in schools.
Or when it comes to arsenic. That is correct.
When it comes to arsenic. Is that a...
No, that's not correct. I'm
well,
sorry.
I wanted to get that clear. That's
the point I was trying to make. That limit, that 0.18, applies to all discharges in the state of Alaska, not just to placer miners.
Well, I was talking about drinking water. How does it compare to that?
I think the answer is yes, you are correct.
The statement the chairman made is correct, and it's 260 times... has 260 times more arsenic in it if we drink it than if we run it through our placer mine?
The state drinking water standard is 50, so yes, it is.
Okay. Thanks for coming back, of course. Is there any interest in the proposed amendments offered by the testifiers and
I guess the only discussion maybe is that I find it somewhat strange that these kind of numbers are apparently existing out there. It would seem to me that I know of many areas where arsenic background levels are much higher than this number. so that even the normal water running off the hillside is quite a bit higher than what this number would be. By this, establishing this number as EPA has done, does that mean if a person wishes to process gravel out there, that they then have to put in some kind of a filtration system that would take out the normal or the naturally occurring background levels of arsenic to get them down to a level that would be 18 parts per billion?
I doubt that a filtration system would do that. I think you'd have to add chemicals. It's mostly in Fairbanks. That's part of the problem with that area.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, there's high arsenic.
No, I had no other discussion.
Was there any interest in... Is there any interest in clarifying this resolution to the testifier said that while it was accurate, it may have not fully represented EPA's personnel. Any interest in an amendment to cover that? I don't see an amendment in there before us. Okay. Further committee discussion? What's the pleasure regarding Senate Joint Resolution 39? Senator Pierce?
Just one question. Have we asked the administration for a position on this, because I understood what Mr. Chambers said, the state was a party to the settlement somehow, and I'm just curious how the state got itself into it. Okay.
I know that this has been posted, even though this is a fairly fast-track item, we did notice it.
Did the administration agree to this? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. Can anybody answer this? Did the administration agree to this settlement?
Yes, sir, they did.
The answer was yes, they did, from Mr. Chambers.
Excuse me, Mr. Lehman?
Yes, this is Mr. Burrell.
Thank you, sir. I would tend to disagree with Mr. Chambers. The administration laid out in a letter from then Deputy Commissioner Michelle Brown a series of several things that, if met, the administration would look kindly on it, but indeed the details of that letter were not met, and we have asked her to withdraw her support and have not heard what her decision is yet.
Okay, we will we'll ask that question. Senator Pierce?
Thank you. Mr. Burrell, was the state, how did the state get involved? Did you ask the state to take a position? Did they do it on their own?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, the state was inquired of at various points during the negotiation between EPA and SCLDEF, and at various points they were asked their opinion. A week and a half ago, I personally met with Commissioner Brown and asked her if she had if she was aware of the multitude of additional items that were not discussed in her letter of November 9th. And she said no, that she was not there. May have been people within her staff that had heard some of the additional pieces, but it's only what was in her letter that she was aware of. And so the state of Alaska was not a party to the suit, but they were involved at some point at the request of EPA, and I can leave it at that.
Well,
Senator Pierce,
If I could follow up. It's very nice, I suppose, that the court or somebody, the EPA and the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, asked the state what they thought. Were you or was the Miners Association ever asked what they thought of some of these wonderful new regulations? I mean, if they were nice enough to ask the state, while Mr. Chambers said he assumed the miners didn't care because they didn't file any briefs, were you ever asked what you thought, the same way the state was?
Yes, ma'am, we were. As a matter of fact, Commissioner Burden specifically called on a couple different occasions. Again, issues that EPA had brought to the state of Alaska called us on a couple occasions and asked for our comments, and some of the things that were in now Commissioner Brown's letter addressed those. But as to being a party and able to file briefs, no, we were not a party.
But you were asked by the state of Alaska, not by the EPA.
Yes, that's correct. There may have been one occasion where the EPA attorney called us, but we did not see a copy of the draft permit until it was put out for public notice. We were not aware of the multitude of details that are in that general permit that never been discussed, again, to my knowledge, with EPA and definitely, to my knowledge, with DEC and definitely not with us. We were asked a few specific questions, and we responded to those.
Why did the miners choose not to actually try to inject themselves into the suit?
Basically two reasons. On the one hand, there were a group of miners at that time that felt they had an agreement between themselves and EPA that the existing general permit was going to be satisfactory. Given that, if you will, a promise, they had not were not interested in pursuing it. And from the standpoint of the rest of the industry, I just have to tell you that people were burned out on being in court. They have, we've spent many thousands of dollars over the years, and when it came, this issue came up in 1994, folks said, no, we're not going to do it. I can tell you that as of this past week, that has all changed, and the mineral industry is coming to the table, and I mean in a big way, because they see additional changes from the previous general permit that will be disastrous for the future.
Thank you.
Hey. Senator Taylor?
Yeah, Steve, I guess I'm concerned that a pattern seems to be developing here, and that is, first let me ask you this question. Has that decision been taken, that settlement decision, has that been given back to the judge yet in the case? For that judge's approval, it's my understanding the judge needs to hold a hearing on the fairness of that decision. Has anyone asked him to do that, or does he still need to do it, or has it been approved by the court?
The settlement has not yet been approved by the court. It's dependent on this draft general permit going forward and EPA meeting several other criteria that are in the settlement between SCLDEF and EPA. That will be taken to the court at some later date, but it has not as yet.
Do you intend to involve yourself at that point?
We would very much like to, but we do not have access to the court at this point.
Yeah, because of your decision not to file an amicus or be involved in an earlier stage.
Correct, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Brell. Mr. Chairman, I guess what bothers me is that this seems to be a pattern of activity that the environmental community files a suit against a federal agency that is the monitoring agency for a given activity. By filing that suit, they then are able to go into a back room, so to speak, with the attorneys on behalf of the federal government, who clearly represent a political point of view from the current administration in Washington, D.C. And what you literally end up with is Katie McGinty, Al Gore, and the heads of that agency sitting down to chat with their friends in the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund about what kind of a settlement should be achieved on their litigation. It's the very same process that we've just gone through in the timber industry, and it's a very frightening aspect when you realize that there's no one seated in that room that is representing the resource or the development interests of the United States. And as a consequence, we end up with settlements coming down that now establish through court order new standards and new requirements without any of the affected people. In this instance, the miners were not involved, and they're the most affected people, being in the room or being allowed to participate because of the way the suit is structured. And in fact, they have to take extraordinary efforts to even involve themselves in the suit and can only get in probably as an amicus, which is a friend of the court and not a true party to the litigation. I just think it's a pattern that we're seeing, and it's a very disturbing one.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pierce.
The state hasn't helped that pattern. To make it worse, if you look at the supplemental bill that came over from the House, in the settlement on one particular case, the Copper River Highway, the state has agreed to pay the environmental group that did the original suit to sue the feds. Give them money for their legal defense fund so they can go into this whole round robin some more, which will happen, by the way, over my dead body.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I like the idea of cutting that out of the supplement.
Oh, I thought you could say you liked the idea of her dead body.
No. Not at all.
Let's not go into that any further.
Is there further discussion regarding Senate Resolution 39?
I'd move the resolution with its zero fiscal note and individual recommendations, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection to the motion to report SGR 39 as amended? Hearing none, the resolution is reported. Next up is Senate Bill 199, Environmental Health and Safety Audits. We have a proposed committee substitute that incorporates some of the changes suggested by the administration and makes other clarifying amendments that some of these are primarily editorial, but we'll have Mike Pauley go through quickly what the changes were in Senator Pierce.
I would move the work draft F Lauterbach 3996 as a working document.
Is there any objection? Does everybody find it? It should be on the top of your packet there, Senator Hoffman. But any objection to that motion? Okay, we have before us CS for Senate Bill 199 Resources, the Lauterbach 3996 version. That's the F version. Mr. Pauley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Pauley, staff aide to sponsor Senator Lehman. Following last week's hearing on Senate Bill 199, we worked with Legal Services to draft a new committee substitute which incorporates certain recommendations we have received from both the business community and the administration. In your packet should be a five-page document entitled Summary of Changes for Version F, which looks like this. And this provides a very detailed section-by-section review of the changes. Many of the changes are technical matters, and in the interest of brevity, I will simply touch on a few of the more substantive changes. First, on the area of privilege, we have added clarifying language which states that if one part of an audit report is disclosed for any reason, then the privilege still applies to the remaining portions of the audit report. This change is necessary because some federal courts have adopted a four-part test for determining claims of privilege on the basis of self-critical analysis. One of the tests requires that information for which privilege is claimed must be kept confidential. This creates a risk that a disclosure of part of a report might be considered a waiver of privilege for all the report. Second change, we have added to the list of non-privileged materials such information that is required in order to obtain, maintain, or renew a license, and also such information that is required under a contract with the state. These changes were made to address concerns expressed by administration representatives. In the area of immunities, we have clarified that a regulated entity which voluntarily reports instances of noncompliance is not only eligible for immunity for the violations reported, but also violations that are based on the facts disclosed and which were unknown to the person making the disclosure. This change was made to address the concern that a person might not be covered by immunity for violations that were discovered as a result of a voluntary disclosure, but which were not declared as violations in the disclosure. This possibility could be a powerful disincentive to voluntarily report violations, and the new language addresses this problem. We have also added an extra requirement for immunity, which is that a regulated entity is required to disclose, under terms of a confidentiality agreement, that part of an audit report which deals with the plan for compliance, but only if the information is requested by the appropriate regulatory agency. This will help the agencies fulfill their responsibility under the bill, which is to work with regulated entities on the implementation of compliance plans. Finally, a new paragraph has been added to the immunity section of the bill. This language clarifies that a regulatory agency may not initiate an investigation of a regulated entity based solely on the fact that the entity has provided a notice of intent to perform a self-audit. Concern was expressed by some members of the business community that a notice to perform an audit might trigger an investigation that would otherwise not have occurred. If such an investigation discovered violations before the self-audit report was completed, then the immunity provision would not apply in these cases. This could create a powerful disincentive against providing notice of intent to conduct an audit. We believe the new language effectively addresses that concern. Thank you. This concludes my testimony.
you didn't mention the deletion of that one paragraph regarding circumvention by regulation prohibited.
My apologies. We did delete the section that the chairman refers to because it is already covered under another part of state law.
And that was also a request by Janice Adair from DEC. So we've actually incorporated at least three major changes that were requested by the DEC, trying to accommodate them, meet them halfway, partway.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Taylor?
Just a question to the chair. Circumvention by regulation is covered in other provisions of state law?
It is covered under AS 4462030. And I've looked at that, and indeed that is correct. Now, what we wanted to make sure that we covered was that not only by regulation, but also by permit or by other administrative action. And it is our legislative intent that the administration not do things that are contrary to statute. And, by taking that out, we're not suggesting that they should have the authority to do that. But we believe that we're covered adequately elsewhere in law.
Why aren't they currently abiding by that state law?
You'll have to ask them. They should be. Any questions of Mr. McCauley? Thank you, Mike. Mike Perkins?
Chairman Lehman, committee members, my name is Dwight Perkins. I'm the special assistant to Commissioner Cashin at the Department of Labor. Last week, this bill had a hearing on it, and Mr. Paul Grossi, our workers' comp director, and Mr. Jeff Carpenter from Occupational Safety in Anchorage both testified on it. Excuse me. They gave the reasons why we had some concerns with this. There was some question on, and I just need to clarify this. There was some questions on the concern of the chairman that, the commissioner did not have a problem with this legislation. And as we did speak, Senator Lehman, with yourself and staff, at that time it was prior to introduction of the bill. And my commissioner had mentioned that the way he saw it is that if it did not change business as we currently do it and it would not impede us from doing our jobs, we didn't know why we'd have a concern with it. After we got the bill, we went through it, and it does change significantly our role in the OSH standard and in workers' comp. I received on March 5th a letter, a fax memo from Mr. Pauley of your office, Senator Lehman, on March the 4th, talking about the CS. On March 5th, and he had asked that we have, excuse me, written comments to you prior to the afternoon of March 6th, which we did give. We did have something prepared on March the 5th, and I apologize for not being here on the 6th. I was in the House Labor and Commerce Committee dealing with three bills. So I apologize for not being here that day. But as was spoken on that day, and I'm not too sure if you folks did get a copy of if this is in your packet yet or not. And so if I may, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, have these. Thank you. I got eight of them. And this was, in summary, pretty much what the testimony was given on the 6th from both OSH and from workers' comp. In addition, there is an attachment for your review from U.S. Department of Labor, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, concurring with our concerns regarding this bill. We did make a couple of suggested changes, which haven't been addressed. We still want to encourage you to work with us for our concerns at the Department of Labor. And on the page two, we just specifically say that add a number three to this under number three, that it would be administrative proceeding except for workers' compensation proceedings. That would be an addition, a comma after number three, and administrative proceeding on page one, line 12. Unless you want me to read the few paragraphs we have regarding Alaska OSH, you folks have it before you, and we can discuss it, or I can read it in the record. But I just wanted to clarify that for the committee, Mr. Chairman, and yourself. And we currently at Department of Labor still have concerns, and we would enjoy working with you and staff to address those. So that concludes my testimony, unless you have other questions.
Thank you, Dwight. I just want to clarify that in my comment last time, at least what I intended to say was the commissioner and you were at that
That's
same
correct,
meeting
sir.
had expressed conceptual support for the idea, then I agree that you had not had adequate chance to review the details of the bill. And I was as much expressing some frustration after waiting after our first hearing that it was only then that we were getting some of these expressions of concern about some of the details, when you'd had that for nearly the first 60 days of the legislature. It was mainly just expressing a frustration with the timing of some of these things.
Yeah, and if I may respond, Senator Lehman, committee members, I during that first hearing some time ago, Department of Law did speak as well as DEC. We ran out of time, and the Department of Labor never got to go on record.
So I agree with you, and I
thank you,
apologize
Mr.
for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Or you have in your document now what we submitted to your staff.
Questions, Mr. Perkins? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Wheeler?
Yet again.
You're going to be an old standby here today. You're going to deserve overtime pay.
For the record, my name is Mark Wheeler with the Environmental Lobby. My comments might be kind of scattered, but we've had limited time to prepare on this recent committee substitute. In the last hearing, we tried to offer some constructive comments to make the last committee substitute a more effective piece of legislation. But not a single concern of ours has been met in this latest draft. We tried to meet with your office, but we were basically lectured to at length, and none of our concerns were even inquired about. We're worried about the health and safety of Alaskan citizens. We think this current piece of legislation shows a blatant disregard for the health of the public. The bill seems to make it harder for DEC and other state agencies to do their jobs by extending the right of privilege to information disclosed in self-audits. It allows industry to get around working toward compliance by excusing persons ignorant of the law and by granting immunity for violations which industry hasn't even acknowledged breaking. I'm addressing your assistant's comments earlier about about voluntary disclosure immunity. Paragraph 1, for a violation based on the facts disclosed and for a violation discovered because of the disclosure that was unknown to the person making the disclosure. It seems that the brunt of knowing about what violations are broken should be borne by the industry. It seems like there should be no forgiveness granted for ignorance of the law. And we also see little evidence in this bill for protection against bad actors. There's not much talk about repeat violators. It seems that on the last page, page 5 of the detailed changes to the bill, paragraph 11, the wording of section 925.475 has been amended as follows: repeated an unreasonable number of times.
Mr. Wheeler, there's no paragraph 11 on page 5.
No. I'm sorry, at the top of page 5, I'm speaking to the summary of changes.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was looking at the bill itself. Go ahead.
That doesn't seem to be too strongly worded. Repeated an unreasonable number of times or continuously committed violations that are the same as or similar to the violation for which immunity is sought under this section. We'd like to see tighter controls for bad actors. It seems pretty unreasonable for somebody to commit a violation over and over and keep receiving immunity for that. We're also concerned about, again, I'm sorry for being so scattered, the interjection of the word substantial when referring to injury or off-site harm incurred by violations. It's on page 4 of the suggested changes, or the summary of changes, number 5. The word substantial is added before injury for consistency purposes. New paragraph reads, a violation did not result in substantial injury to one or more persons at the site or substantial off-site harm to persons, property, and environment. We even asked for stricter language, asking that a self-audit must not have presented an imminent and substantial endangerment to the public health or the environment. We just would like to see a little more protection of workers and public surrounding industry. As we see, this bill is nothing more than an attempt to let the fox guard the hen house. And we're concerned if this bill becomes law, we might be faced with an empty hen house. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. It took until this day, until somebody testifying used that phrase, but I predicted when I filed it that would eventually be used by somebody.
Sure.
And, eventually that happens. That certainly is not the intent of this legislation. It's to do just the opposite of that. It's to get people to come into compliance with environmental laws. And, I believe the bill has been crafted to accomplish that. I know that you disagree with that, but I would like to address some of your concerns, if I may, from the chair. You'd say, this shows a blatant disregard for health of the public. I disagree with that. Instead, I believe that what we're going to see are people who currently now either aren't or don't know that they aren't complying with environmental laws will come into compliance. There will be an incentive for them to do so. The repeat and the bad actors, I believe that the clarifying language we put in there just helps ensure that, that bad actors are not protected and that it just helps define what bad actors are. Substantial on page 4, item number 5 in this summary of changes, that is at the request of DEC just to make sure that we have some consistency about the harm to individuals and off-site harm. We just want to make sure we have that clarifying consistency. It's from the department, and I've already responded to your comment about the fox guarding the hen house. So.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Comments or any questions of this testifier? Thank you for joining us. Paul Grassi, you said you're available for questions. Did you wish to testify, or did you? Okay. Is there anybody who wants to ask questions of Mr. Grassi with workers' comp? Any discussion?
Any witnesses?
There are no other witnesses signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 199? Oh, I'm sorry. I do have Janice Adair talking about you. You must have heard your ears burning. Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Janice Adair, and I'm representing DEC. We continue to have concerns with the privilege. We continue to have concerns that immunity is provided for criminal activities, and we continue to have concerns with the broad definition of environmental health and safety law. And for the record, I just would like to point out that on the section regarding substantial harm and substantial injury, I simply pointed out there was inconsistency in that section in the last VM.
Thank you. And when you pointed it out, we took a look at it and agreed with you and offered a change to help clarify it. Questions of Ms. Adair? Any discussion regarding Senate Bill 199?
Do you have other witnesses?
No.
I did have a question. Is there anyone here who is here to speak on behalf of the Department of Fish and Game on their $66,500 fiscal note that they've submitted with the bill?
Yeah, my name is Jaron Bruce, representing Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
I guess I'm confused. I would have thought that the Department of Fish and Game probably has some working relationship with DEC on pollution concerns that would be addressed in this legislation, and I was trying to understand how, by granting this opportunity for people to come into compliance, that your department would need to hire additional staff.
To the chair, Senator Taylor, what we're looking at there is our authority under 1605-870, which regards anadromous streams and crossings and other activities in the streams. And because of the broad application of privilege and immunity to information provided by this legislation, we feel we would have to have some increased effort to develop our own sources of information when we suspected that violations were occurring. In the past, we've generally had good relationships with the actual companies in the field, and we've gone to them for a lot of information, but we don't think that that will be as likely to continue under this legislation as it has in the past. Most violations that come to our attention are reported by the public. The public sees a stream running muddy or something like that, and we in the past would typically have gone to the operator to find out what was going on. We think probably under this legislation we will have to do some additional investigative work of our own. That's the reason for the fiscal note.
I guess that's why I'm confused. Why would you have to do... It sounds as though from the comments here in the analysis, you said additional staff is needed to detect violations and to allow the state to develop, I assume the word is its own independent information to ensure compliance with its Title 16 laws and regulations. In fact, the self-audit would be an effort to comply and would only impact the law if, in fact, it did. It sounds like you're saying that because you've been able to use reports freely in the past to then go out and prosecute people under Title 16, that now you may not be able to prosecute them because of the compliance, or I should say because of the reporting opportunity allowed through self-audit. And therefore, since you might be prevented from citing somebody, you need more staff so you can go out and gather the information from independent sources so you'll still be able to prosecute even though the person is doing a self-audit. Am I misreading that somehow?
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, I think that perhaps where we're seeing things differently is in terms of developing the balance between allowing private industry to conduct their business and our responsibility to protect the public resource. I think that you know, we're not eager to prosecute people, and in fact we have very few prosecutions under our authorities to protect anadromous fish streams. We generally try to work with operators up front, prevent problems, and then when problems are detected, to work with them to correct them. But it's our view, and I'm, you know, this certainly could be, you know, people can have different points of view on that, but it is our view that because of the broad nature of this legislation, that some operators may not be willing to cooperate with us in the same way that they have in the past, and we may have to develop independent legislation, independent information where we think violations have occurred, because they will see this as a way, in a sense, to shield themselves from actions that they've undertaken which were not in compliance with the anadromous stream protections.
But that's very confusing.
Yeah, Mr. Bruce, the protection of a self-audit only applies if the party who does the audit makes immediate or, you know, changes and comes into compliance with the law. You know, I don't understand this either. In fact, we should be seeing negative fiscal notes from all departments. I think we probably haven't done an adequate job of explaining this legislation. It's obvious from these fiscal notes that we haven't. And I know you're not responsible for the other departments, but to get these suggests to me that it is nothing more than the department saying, we don't like this legislation, therefore we're going to put positive fiscal notes on. This is totally contrary to what this the the rationale is behind this legislation. It's to encourage people to do what's right. And if they don't make the change immediately, they don't get any protection. Okay? I mean, are you saying that you believe that Alaskans are inherently dishonest and will not, when they detect these things, want to come into compliance so they get the protection?
Senator, no, I'm not saying Alaskans are inherently dishonest, but I'm saying that, but I think we have to recognize that there are some number of people operating who will take advantage of opportunities to cut corners for their own advantage, and if that harms public resources, they will make that trade-off, and that's why we have laws and why we have enforcement. If everybody lived by the golden rule, then we could certainly reduce the cost of government significantly, but there are folks out there, a minority, that we will encounter who will, we believe, use this legislation to attempt to shield themselves.
Senator Taylor?
If I could, and I didn't mean to interrupt your colloquy there, but could you give me some kind of example of how this might work? I'm having the hardest time in my mind figuring out how an operator would go out, intentionally do something wrong, and then by doing a self-audit and coming into compliance and correcting whatever mistake or problem they had made, that this would somehow shield them. The only thing I can imagine it shields them from is a nuisance thing from your department coming out there saying, oh, you should have done it quicker. I'm having a hard time visualizing this. Maybe you could cite me to just a hypothetical example that would clarify your concerns about people somehow using this as an inappropriate shield. Like the chairman, I can't imagine how they could do that, but if you could give me an example, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I'm certain I can give you an example. I can probably give you more than one example. You know, off the top of my head, let's say we had an individual who, I mean, the way the statute works, our statute works, is someone who's going to engage in some kind of activities in an anadromous fish stream is supposed to notify the department, supply plans and specifications about what they intend to do, and then receive a permit from us. After that activity occurs, they then pretty much operate on their own. We don't have the staff to do much follow-up work. If, for example, let's say that they had certain terms that had been agreed to in that, to get that permit, and then down the course of the next 6 months of their operation or whatever, they deviated from those terms and resulted in some damage to the stream, they could conduct one of these audits, disclose the information, then perhaps engage in some activity to correct the problem. We would be in a situation to argue with them about whether or not their corrective action was actually, you know, what equal to what we thought it should be. But that's the kind of example. Somebody gets a permit from us based on a laying out what they think to do. Then people are working out in an area. Circumstances develop. Maybe they're behind schedule. Maybe they're using an ice bridge to cross or something, and the ice bridge goes away, and they continue to go across there without that. And then that's an example, a general example of the kind of thing that we think might occur in this.
But to use your example and the chair's comments, they would not be the recipient of any benefit if they did not comply with the law and do the cleanup required. And it would be a cleanup required by DEC, and I would imagine your department would be consulted on that cleanup as to what's the best remedial action. And they don't get this shield if they haven't cleaned up their act. That's the part I'm having. Really believe people would be so devious to go out to get a permit, then intentionally violate the permit, then intentionally go clean it all up in compliance with DEC so that nobody could cite them for violating their permit? Because that's kind of how it sounds.
I note that there is no protection against that type of intentional action
and that,
anyway.
And that is specifically addressed in here, should you try to do that.
Well, our fiscal note address, you know, the thing here that we're looking at is the cost of collecting the information to demonstrate that a violation has occurred and then to take, you know, if we were to go to court or something of that nature. And what our fiscal note addresses is that if we will have to independently develop information concerning the alleged violation if we cannot get the information from the operator themselves because they have conducted an audit and the information is then confidential. That's what our fiscal note addresses, the additional requirement that we will have to get independent information, which in the past we could have turned to the operator and got. I realize that this is that I realize, Senator, that you are disappointed with the fiscal notes and that your intention here is to try to reduce the need for regulation, but I think what you're seeing from us is that we don't really view that the outcome that you're looking for is going to occur.
Well, I believe that you have the capacity to put in permit conditions that people would need to operate under, and those permit conditions are not protected under the audit. I mean, those are still going to be available to you. So you have those conditions already in your permits. So I don't understand what information you think is going to be unavailable to you that you know, a self-audit would somehow protect.
Perhaps it would be helpful, Senator, if we were to get with your staff or something with some of our field people and we could actually walk through some more examples in a little more detail than I'm able to give you here today.
Okay. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help your department do its job and the other departments, and I'm just a little frustrated. We get resistance from the very people we're trying to help do their job, especially in a time we have declining revenues. We're not going to have as many people available to be doing inspections or as often, and we're hearing testimony about this in the subcommittees. We're hearing testimonies about this also, and so a bill like this comes along with an idea, and everybody says, conceptually, I agree with you. But then we hear testimony after testimony saying, but don't apply it to me. But if you apply it to me, it's going to take another, we're going to have to hire one more staff person because we may not be getting this information. See, it doesn't make sense. If we agree conceptually, then we should be working with this legislation trying to make it work as good as possible, not trying to defeat it.
Senator, we are not trying to defeat it. I want to reiterate what other folks from other agencies have said. You know, we are trying to work with you and your staff here and the committee to get there. But as we all know, the devil's in the details, and sometimes it takes a while to get from an idea to an actual solution.
I know that, but it's not like this is that far-fetched. This same thing is in law in 14 other states, and we're hearing testimony from these other states that it's working fine. In fact, they like it. And so, you know, it's not, this will not be the first time this idea of environmental and health and safety self-audits has been applied.
Just as an example, has your department talked with the fish and game departments in any of these other 14 states to find out if they needed additional monies for their budget so they could go out and do additional policing because somehow now they would be prevented the utilization of some information that they would have received before?
Senator, through the chair, Senator Taylor, no, we haven't. I mean, I guess one of the reasons we didn't contact the state of Texas is there's so much difference between the two states. I mean, Texas doesn't have salmon resources, and that's what we're very concerned about here in Alaska is our salmon resources. So I'm not sure that their experience there could help us that much with unique laws that we have on the books here in Alaska to protect our salmon resources, which they don't have in Texas.
Well, yeah, I can understand focusing on the salmon resource, but unless I'm mistaken, we've had 16 record years of salmon production. We're the only people on the West Coast of the United States still producing salmon. I mean, Washington State certainly doesn't have any real record there, nor does Oregon, and B.C. wants to steal most of our salmon. So I would think that there must be other departments of fish and game that have been very concerned about other species that they have and that have probably had some type of concerns when it came to environmental pollution and other problems that would be very helpful to you in addressing how is it working down there? Do these other departments of Fish and Game find that it's working good and that they're accomplishing things now that they weren't getting before? I mean, wouldn't it be nice to know that some person that had a road slide in or something out there in a salmon stream immediately did everything they could to remediate the problem, as opposed to trying to hide it or cover it up or wait for one of your inspectors to come out? I would think that's the kind of activity we want to encourage people in Fish and Game right now. If a person goes out hunting for a bull moose and accidentally shoots a cow moose, we expect that person to bring that meat in. We distribute it to senior centers. We expect them to turn themselves in. And if, in fact, they do, they receive a much reduced penalty for having done so. Your suggestion is that, well, if they do that, and then we would have to have our own independent source of information so we could prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law, because that's the only difference between self-audit and what's going on right now, is being able to prosecute to the full extent of the law, where this would somehow reduce your ability to prosecute because the person did something good on their own to try and clean up the mess. Like the senator from Anchorage just suggested here, I think it's good to encourage people to do the right thing instead of waiting for a policeman to hit them over the head to make them do the right thing. You know?
Senator, we agree with you completely, and that's why I said earlier we don't engage in a lot of prosecution under our authority, but we do have the stick there, which is useful in some cases. But we try to encourage positive behavior. We work up front with folks. We work after the fact. If somebody comes to us, we take it into consideration exactly as you. Is your example with the moose indicated. We already do that. We already have that authority. That's working. And we really believe that, you know, since we are the ones with the salmon resource left, that it's better that I'm not sure how much we want to be going and looking at what they're doing in Oregon and California and other places. I think they more should be looking at what we are doing, because clearly we're doing something right. Because we still have the salmon resources, and part of what we are doing right is we have, since statehood, protected our habitat, and we've placed a high importance on it, and the legislature and you know, has a very good record there. So I think that we're not eager to move away from that because it has been successful.
And I guess your bottom line is you have some fears within this legislation that we may somehow be moving away from the ability of your department to prosecute to the full extent of the law. Is that what I'm hearing?
To the chair, Senator Taylor, prosecution is only there, I think, in our view, as, you know, the ultimate stick. We are trying to encourage and bring about cooperation and positive behavior, and certainly if there's a way we can get that, That's our choice, but as I said earlier, there is some, with some people, you know, you do need the stick, and I think that's just a fact of life.
Well, thank you.
I'll note that Oregon does have salmon, or at least used to, and they're anxious to restore them, and I agree with you that Alaska has done a much better job in habitat protection. But Oregon is working toward restoring habitat and has had some remarkable success. And Oregon is one of the first states to adopt an environmental self-audit program. And, you know, from what I understand, it is working. And I think it's in conjunction, you know, with the desire to restore fish habitat.
Senator, we're ready to work with you still.
Great. Is there further committee discussion regarding this bill? Senator Hoffman?
I'll move the Labor's Amendment on page 1, line 12, to add after proceeding, except for workers' compensation proceedings.
Any objection to that? No objection? Hearing no objection, that amendment carries. Is there further discussion regarding Senate Bill 199 as amended?
Move bill from committee as amended with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to reporting Senate Bill 199 from committee? Hearing none. Senate Bill 199 is reported from the Resource Committee. Next, we'll take up Senate Bill 262, Act Relating to Management of Game Populations. Mary Gore.
For the record, I am Mary Gore, staff to Senator Miller, and I've gone through the bill and have the changes highlighted. On page one, we're adding a new section or a new sentence on line nine. In areas where human harvest has been found to be an important use of game, game populations in those areas shall be managed. That's a new addition there. And that's just to add more emphasis. On page two, the new areas opened by the board, it used to say would be five times larger than the area that was closed. It's now going to be three times larger than the area that was closed.
Page two, line seven.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Page four. We have added in on line one, greater than, and on line 19. The section was guaranteeing access to and continued public sport fishing, hunting, trapping activities and opportunities on state game refuge consistent with maximum sustained yield. It's just changed to guaranteeing access to and for continued consumptive uses. And that's it. This was a compromise reached by the people in Fairbanks that wished the bill to happen and Tanana Chiefs.
I'd move adoption of the committee substitute, Uttermole 3896, letter G, upper right corner.
Is there any objection to having CS Senate Bill number 260 Resources, the Uttermole G version before us for the markup vehicle? Hearing none, we have before us the CS. Any questions of Ms. Gore, Senator Hoffman?
With the changes, does the Tanana Chiefs Conference support this legislation now?
Yes, they do. It should be online.
Are they online?
We do have people online to testify. It is my intent that this bill, we'll report this bill today, and I just want to let people know that they can testify. I'd prefer that their testimony be short. But any further questions of Ms. Gore? You're welcome to stay at the table if you'd like. And we'll go to Fairbanks. Lynn Levengood.
Someone who's done it.
I thought you said.
Thank you, Lynn Levengood, Fairbanks. Can you hear me?
No,
you
said 66.
Mr. Speaker, Fairbanks, Lynn Levengood, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Thank you. Lynn Levengood, 931, by the way, Fairbanks. Just to be very
we
brief,
made the side win.
We support the committee substitute that was outlined by the first speaker, and this is compromised language which was worked out. The legislation is absolutely necessary to reverse the plummeting loss of consumptive use opportunities by politically based closures to consumptive uses. Just in the last 6 months, over 200 square mile area in the Alaska Flint Zone has been closed without biological justification. 91 square miles in the Matthew area, and goes on and on. Since the last hearing, the ambiguous language, which drew some concern, has been eliminated, and the changes that were necessary, the changes that were outlined were made. We urge you to support this legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Levengood. No questions for you right now. Eric Holland, and then standing by, Dan Ritzman. Okay, I'm sorry. I see that note. Bill Perhuck? And then standing by Ken Taylor.
Record. My name is Bill Perhatch. I'm a volunteer with the Alaska Environmental Lobby. I have a position paper which I hope the committee will look at another day. For the moment, what I'd like to focus on is one point that's made in the bill. It's assertion that game population should be managed solely for maximum sustained yield by human harvest, and its assumption that consumptive use of game is the highest and best use. I'm from the Denali Borough. Like a lot of people in the Denali Borough, I make my living through tourism. I've worked for about 14 years with the package cruise ship tour segment of the market, and the last 6 years in ecotourism, which is just booming. So 20 years, over that 20 years, I've seen in the Denali area, which is the area I'm familiar with. I don't know what's going on in Southeast or Prince William Sound. Tourism growth between 3 and 15% every year, including through the 80s, when everybody else was going bust. If we have less than 5% growth, it's a bad year. What we're selling at Denali Park, we got two things. We've got the mountain, and we've got watchable wildlife. You can't do much about the mountain. It's there, it's not, and most of the summer on the north side of the range, it's not there. But the critters are still there in Denali. We sometimes forget that just because this is within a national park, you know, that these animals can be affected by things that are going on the perimeter of the park. We have the broad pasture area, which is Unit 13. The Park Herd and the Nelchina Herd interchange in that area. We have the Yannert Valley, which is Unit 20A, which was in the news quite a bit last year, if you recall. We have the Wolf Townships, Unit 20C. All of these areas, there's a considerable amount of hunting going on. The critters don't acknowledge that there's any difference between the Wolf Townships and the park. They're in, they're out. Yannert Valley, they're in, they're out. Same thing. What we're looking for right now is some sort of acknowledgement that this watchable wildlife is a product. It's a kind of a subsistence activity, really. Tourism, for us, it's a way we make our living. Non-consumptive use of the wildlife. I'd like to point out one more thing. Senator Miller sponsored this bill, my senator. We have two native corporations in the Denali Borough right now which are looking at tourism. They're saying, well, we can't continue to live off of resource extraction. We're going to have to start looking for something else, and it's tourism. We have Otna, which is actively engaged in a project right now in Broad Pass. And we have the Doyon Corporation, which just bought a property in the Kantishna. It's going to be interesting over the next year or so as Doyon becomes aware of the situation in the Kantishna. You know, in the Kantishna, subsistence hunting is allowed. This is in the very heart of the park. There are several communities, actually, that can access the Kantishna for subsistence hunting. They would include things, villages like Nikolai and Talida, Lake Machumino. Actually, the only community that would really go in there of all those would be Cantwell. And there's no roster. If you live within a half mile of the flagpole at the post office in Cantwell, you can hunt in Kantishna. And I submit to you that once Doyon is in there trying to make a living from tourism, that they might be approaching Senator Miller for some relief. That's my testimony.
Any questions, Mr. Perhatch? Senator Halford? Let me just note that we've been joined by Senator Frank.
Just a question in terms of, you know, one of the conflicts that this comes out of is the source of funding for the management. Do you think it's reasonable for all the management of these resources to be paid for by the taxes, revenue sharing, and license fees of hunters.
No, you know, I hadn't thought about it, but as you mentioned it, I don't see why the tourist industry shouldn't contribute.
Well, that's one of the, I mean, there are two sides to the debate, and one of them that's, I think, equally strong is the other one, is that it's the consumptive users feel that their fees are paying for the non-consumptive users. And I think that point is very well taken, you know, even aside from the other arguments about sustained yield for human consumption versus for other uses.
Perhaps if non-consumptive use was being recognized, they'd be more willing to pony up.
I've made those suggestions to the ATMC, and I think they're beginning to listen. Senator Taylor?
Your testimony seems to indicate, and if I'm misconstruing it, please correct me, indicates that almost a mutually exclusive attitude as concerns utilization or the management and utilization of these game populations that you participate in viewing. Do you believe that? Do you believe that allowing hunting and management for consumptive purposes it is somehow going to be detrimental to those people who would view?
And the Chair, Senator. Certainly. Senator, the folks that I've been dealing with, the guests that I've been dealing with, the packaged cruise ship tour guests, and now ecotourists, and these are I'm working at a rather exclusive facility now, so these are high-end guests. They're not going to get off of a road corridor for their experience. You know, the cruise ships come through. Everything's pretty soft for these folks. And that's where I work, in areas that are accessible by vehicle. We might take short walks, but they're short. So I don't have any problem with subsistence and recreational hunting. I help people who work for their meat. I'll go in and help them get it out. It's the people who are hunting in the road corridors that are a problem for me and my clientele. If we've got people blasting moose in downtown Kantishna, we're going to drive those critters out, and we are not going to have them there to see. You go along the Denali Highway, you're not going to see a lot. You know, the game is there. But my point is that you have to work for the game, I believe. And too many people now are just interested in hunting from the road. And that's the type of hunting that I'm trying to stall.
Well, I guess my concern was that we had testimony when this bill came up during the last hearing from Wayne Reglin of the department, who's responsible for big game management in the state, that the, I believe it was the country of Sweden, currently harvests over 100,000 moose per year. That is a greater population of moose than we have in the entire state, and that we are currently harvesting about 7,300 moose per year. And it would seem that if we were aggressively managing just the moose population alone so as to provide for a greater level of harvest, there would be a much larger number of moose available for viewing, because viewing can go on throughout the year, where harvest is going to be limited to a very narrow corridor in time. It would seem to me that, contrary to your testimony, that the exact opposite would occur. If we had people aggressively managing habitat and aggressively managing the species so as to provide for a greater consumptive use opportunity, that as a person viewing those same critters, you would have a lot more of them to see and to show people.
I'm not really qualified to comment, but off the top of my head, I'll say that my major problem with this bill and actually a series of bills like this is that they are simplistic. And what we're dealing with is a complex issue. I don't think that we can predict exactly what the impact is going to be if
if we continue to allow this type of access to game. I'm just not qualified to say, but my sense is that based on anecdotal evidence, as the hunting from the road increases, the game year-round disappears. I can go out there on the Denali Highway. Doesn't really matter what time of the year I go out there. I'm going to have a difficult time finding critters. Not so in the park.
So limitation, aside from this overall state policy of adopting this type of consumptive mission, a restriction on hunting within a distance of road corridors might very well, if your theory is correct, force the concentration of animals into habitat conservation zones or protected zones where you'd have all kinds of them to view because they couldn't be hunted because they were being, quote, driven out of the other areas by hunters.
Senator, my primary concern, most important thing to me, is to get an acknowledgement that non-consumptive use of wildlife is just as important as consumptive use. That's the most important thing to me. The game management issues, as I said, I'm not really qualified to comment. Those are very complex. I don't think that this legislation deals with the complexity. I think it just cuts to the chase. What I would like to see, though, is the recognition that there are a lot of people in my borough, fully 25% of the people, fully 25% of the people that live in that borough make their living from tourism.
That's the number.
It's probably the most robust sector of our economy right now in terms of growth. It needs to have that acknowledgement that it's got every right. Watchable wildlife is just as important as consumptive use of wildlife.
Senator Halford.
Would you be satisfied if the wildlife were managed according to a public mandate? Do you think that in that exchange in the state of Alaska among Alaska residents that you'd win in that battle?
That I would win?
Your point of view would prevail?
I believe it would.